May it please the court, my name is Robert Oakley. I'm here from the Department of Justice on behalf of the Department of Interior. Your Honors, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if that's going to work. I'd like to begin by pointing out how the district court misanalyzed the Interior Board of Land Appeals decision that invalidated Orion's oil shale mining claims. The district court held that this was done on a basis of a retroactive application of Interior's injunctions. Now, if you look at the Interior Board's decision, which appears in particular at pages 40 to 42 of the joint appendix, you'll see that regulations are not mentioned in the legal discussion. There's only one mention of what would be the applicable regulations in that decision, and that's done as a historical matter, noting a change in regulations. Rather, what the district court relied on is the Supreme Court's decision in the Hickel case and the Tenth Circuit's decision in Cliff Sinfuels and ExxonMobil, the Tenth Circuit, of course, being the circuit where Orion's claims are located. And based on those decisions, the court held that Orion's substantial failure to do assessment work for periods of between 15 and 35 years was sufficient to give Interior a valid basis to invalidate those claims. Now, as we point out, particularly in our response reply brief, judicial decisions like Hickel are inherently retroactive, and that's the Supreme Court has established that beyond any doubt in the recent decisions of Harper versus Virginia Department of Taxation and Reynoldsville Casket Company. It matters not that Orion or any other entity may have relied on the Supreme Court case law as it existed prior to the Hickel decision. In Reynoldsville Casket, the Supreme Court upheld throwing out of a lawsuit brought under Ohio law that when that lawsuit was brought was perfectly valid. However, after that lawsuit was brought, the Supreme Court held that the statute of limitations in place in Ohio was invalid as a violation of the Commerce Clause, and thus held in a later case, in the Reynoldsville Casket case, that that case could not proceed, even though there had arguably been reliance, or could have arguably been reliance in the statute. So the retroactivity here, if that term is to be used, is that as of judicial decisions, not regulations. Now, once the Supreme Court decision issued its decision in Hickel, saying that substantial failure to do assessment work could lead to invalidation of claims, Interior's regulations holding to the contrary simply became invalid. That's been the rule under IRS cases. It's been the rule consistently that Interior Department cannot give away land in violation of federal law, and in this case, as construed by the Supreme Court. Had that not been true, that is, if the Supreme Court wanted the issue of regulations, if they felt that that was a valid defense, then the Hickel decision becomes an advisory opinion, because the court, in footnote 5 in that opinion, quotes the applicable regulation, which says at that time, in line with prior Supreme Court law, that the court that failure to do assessment work was a matter only between relocators and claimants. Now, as the court points out in Hickel, because of the Mineral Leasing Act passed in 1920, and these claims, of course, predate the Mineral Leasing Act. They're subject to the General Mining Law of 1873. I'm off by only 100 years. Oil shale lands are no longer subject to relocation. They can only be leased. And thus, allowing failure to assessment work, to do assessment work, to be addressed by having a relocator place a claim is simply no longer an effective means of dealing with the situation. No one can relocate on an oil shale claim. No one could displace Orion now for failure to do assessment work. And that was one of the main reasons behind the court's decision in the Hickel case.
But why shouldn't intent have some role in inquiry even after Hickel?
Well, it certainly wasn't recognized as an issue in Hickel, in that the court, while it did say that this was could be considered equivalent to abandonment, did not say that it was abandonment, and did not list intent as a factor. And it says, and this is from page 57, 400 U.S. at page 57, that we now hold that token assessment work or assessment work that does not substantially satisfy the requirements of 30 U.S.C. Section 28.
That's the question. What's substantial compliance? And why can't, I mean, the Locke Court seems to indicate that intent can be a component of that. Why shouldn't that be fair grounds for inquiry here?
Well, let me break that down into several parts. First, I would note that at no point in the administrative proceedings did Orion attempt to introduce evidence of intent to maintain the claim. So they never raised it before the IBLA. They could have submitted some kind of evidence, and they simply didn't. So I'd say they waived it even if it were relevant. But I'd say that it's not relevant if you go to First Hickel, because the court speaks in, when it's listing the issues that are left, it's talking about giving the claimants an opportunity to bring their claims within the narrow ambit of Krushnick and Virginia, Colorado, as we have construed and limited these opinions. Now, in those opinions, the failure to do assessment work was for 1 year in one case and 1 year in the second case, but in the second case in Virginia, Colorado, my recollection is steps had been taken to resume the assessment work at the time Interior brought the challenge to the claim. And so what Hickel is saying is that this is really an objective test. You can look at the period of time, and if we were talking about failure to do assessment work of 1 year or close to 1 year, I think Orion might have a claim. But we lay out, and they're not disputed, that the based on the county records in Utah, that the periods are between 15 and 35 years for these parcels. And as to Locke didn't really say that there was an intent claim. Locke was dealing with the problem, or the issue rather, that whether intent was a relevant inquiry under FLIPMA, where the statute said you had to make payment prior to December 31st, and they made payment on December 31st, and Interior invalidated the claim, and the statute said that if you didn't make payment, it would be deemed abandonment. Well, as Your Honor is raising the point, abandonment usually needs a showing of intent, and they held intent was irrelevant. I mean, I think we could all think that if they only missed it by one day and not misread prior to December 31st, it's meaning up to and including December 31st. They probably didn't intend to give up on the claims. But it then looked back at Hickel and said of Hickel that all Hickel did was to say that for failure to do assessment work, that might not be an automatic disqualification, but it's looking back really to, again, the limiting of Virginia, Colorado, and Krushnick to their facts, so that you've got a short period of noncompliance with the assessment work. That might not be substantial enough to invalidate the claims. But again, these periods are much closer to the periods found insufficient in the Tenth Circuit cases, Cliff Sinfuels and ExxonMobil.
All that said, I'm not sure what you're telling us about Locke.
I'm sorry, that I haven't told you. I'm sorry, what?
Well, Locke seems to rewrite Hickel. Reinterpret.
I don't believe that it does, Your Honor. If I could have just a moment. Now, what the court said in Locke is that Hickel, quote, suggested, although it did not hold, that failure to meet assessment work requirements, and I'm leaving out a few words, would not render a claim automatically void. Instead, if an individual complied substantially but not fully with the requirement, he might, under some circumstances, be able to retain possession of the claim. Now, first, the statement's clearly dicta. The court is saying, well, under...
I know, but it's their...
It is Supreme Court dicta.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
But it's also very vague. It's saying that Hickel suggested, and that is the court's word in Locke, suggested that you might be able to retain your claim if you had not done annual assessment work, so long as, quote, you complied substantially but not fully with a requirement. It goes on, he might under some circumstances be able to retain possession of this claim. So here we have no effort to introduce intent. and also such a substantial failure, and that goes back again, I think, to the Hickel decision. And I don't see any instance that they really intended to rewrite Hickel where they say a substantial failure. And there's never really been an argument here that these periods of time are not substantial. By Ryan, I don't see how they can be. Go up to 35 years, which is roughly, well, it's more than one-third of the time since the claims.
Let me ask two questions about Hickel. One is, although we certainly give effect to Supreme Court dicta, it has to be considered. That is, it has to consider the issue that we're facing in our case. And, in fact, this wasn't the issue in Locke. This was only the question is how, whether Hickel foreclosed a certain decision in Locke, but the accurate description of Hickel really is sort of irrelevant to Locke. But second, dicta, but not considered in the sense of intended to change the view of Hickel. Where some dicta might be intended for that purpose, even though it's not necessary for the holding. This dicta doesn't appear to be, they don't appear to, it doesn't matter to them. But the other question I have is, what it says is, in Locke, in addition, the general mining laws at issue in Hickel do not clearly provide that a claim will be lost for failure to meet the assessment requirement. Thus was open to the court to conclude in Hickel that Congress had intended to make the assessment work requirement merely an indicium of a claimant's specific intent to retain a claim. That's not inconsistent with the idea that if you substantially comply, then that shows that you actually intend to go forward as an objective matter, but that if you only provide token compliance, that objectively shows you don't intend to go forward, without leading to the question of whether we have to put somebody on the stand to say what they meant by only token applying.
I think that's correct. I think what Hickel held, and Locke didn't change this, is that if you're close to the facts of the two prior Supreme Court cases, there might be a question. But where the period of noncompliance, and in this case is up to 35 years of no assessment work and no contrary evidence introduced at any point that the assessment work was in fact done, nor was there any intent to or effort to introduce intent, that at some point, and it certainly, I think, in the 15 to 35 year range, it becomes clear that whatever someone may say their intent was, the claim has in effect been abandoned. There has not been substantial compliance. The claim has not been maintained as required both by the mining law and by the Mineral Leasing Act.
Well, just suppose for the moment that Orion is correct that it was denied an opportunity to proffer evidence. Might have all sorts of contemporaneous correspondence or what have you about dating back to the period when there were no assessment affidavits filed about reflect their bearing on its intent.
Well, I think that knocks it. I think it's if the question is simply on intent as opposed to whether the assessment work was actually done, I think under Hickel the time period is so great that their evidence of intent would be irrelevant. In any event, the regulations do allow them to both request an evidentiary hearing. They did not. They could have attached documents to their filings before the IBLA. They did not. So I think even if the issue had merit, it would be waived.
You're into your rebuttal time if you want.
All right, then I'll hold off now and wait for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court. I'd like to start with an analysis of whether the proceedings within the department involve disputed issues of material fact, in part because the IBLA seems to agree that if the proceedings did involve disputed issues of material fact, Ryan was entitled to have a complaint served upon it with an assured right for an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing. Proceedings began with a summary of years in which the department investigators had concluded that affidavits of assessment work had been or had not been filed for 156 different claims. This was a factual document. The Bureau of Land Management did not submit that document to Orion in advance of its decision, so it started with a potential serious factual dispute.
Orion, that's a factual assertion by BLM. Where's the dispute?
It's a potential dispute. It's before the case has even started.
BLM puts out a document. You want to dispute it.
Well, our opportunity to respond to the decision, Your Honor, was to file a statement of reasons for appeal within 30 days. And we did file that statement. We did not admit the accuracy of the summary.
What page in the appendix is the, is it in the appendix?
Yes, it starts at page 231 of the appendix, our statement of appeal, statement of reasons.
231?
It does not admit the accuracy of that, does not deny it. It says instead at page 235, note 1, that the record is inadequate to resolve factual issues.
But does it say what facts you would dispute or what facts?
I think it was any factual issues because there had been no opportunity for an evidentiary hearing.
But let me leave aside
and
whether
the department says, well, you didn't submit evidence. We didn't have an opportunity.
This is a fact question. Is there any place, any pleading in which you said we would like to put on evidence that we, as Judge Ginsburg suggested, correspondence about what our intent was or evidence that we actually did do the assessments even though we didn't file, anything like that?
We repeatedly asked, at least twice before this BLM decision and then shortly after it, we said we were entitled to notice of charges and an opportunity for a hearing to present evidence. It was a general objection that the department's proceedings were going to be procedurally improper.
Is the answer no to the question, did you ever proffer which facts?
No, we did not. Let me go on. I'll come back to that point if I may. Other material facts that we say were disputed. We did say in argument in the district court in our opening brief that for purposes of argument but not conceding the accuracy of the summary, we presented certain arguments. In our reply brief, we said we weren't actively contesting that, but we never admitted its accuracy. But that is only one of a number of issues. Our statement of reasons in paragraph 2 denied BLM's finding that Orion had had an ample opportunity to present evidence of pre-1970 work. Paragraph 9 of this statement denies BLM's finding that the Utah statute requires filing of affidavits.
That's a law question, though, isn't it?
Well, they use it as a fact
issue. Is it a law? I mean, we would review that as a matter of law. Either the statute does or doesn't.
But the Interior Department uses it as a fact, said you were in fact required to do this, you didn't file it, therefore adverse inferences of fact can be drawn. Paragraph 10, if I may continue, disputes the key inference that BLM made and IBLA made, the key inference of no work being performed from the fact that, presumed fact, that no affidavit had been filed. That was certainly a material disputed fact. And we said we wanted to present evidence in that. Paragraph 10 of the statement also denies BLM's finding of abandonment. You may recall the BLM decision concludes with a reference to the Utah statute that requires, that provides forfeiture, says you did not comply with the Utah statute, and therefore, your claims are declared abandoned. We denied abandoned, and we submit that plays squarely an issue, the intent of the claim owners at the time that affidavits of work had not been filed. HICL itself had indicated that non-performance of work could be evidence of abandonment. So we say that The intent of the owners was placed in issue by our denial of the finding of abandonment. We also, in paragraph 14, presented an affirmative defense, which is based on extensive potential factual or documentary evidence that that the United States and the Interior Department had maintained a rule that a rule specific to oil shale claims that the United States had no interest in performance of assessment work. Paragraph 15 presented another affirmative defense.
You're looking at paragraph 14 of the same document?
Yes, I believe so.
The, what page in the JA is that? I don't have that paragraph.
I have two paragraph 18s.
I have two paragraph 18s. I think there's something missing. And the two paragraphs 18 I have are different from one another.
Yes, there are two.
So is something misnumbered? What should? How does 14 begin? Or how should it begin?
Actually, I think I misspoke. It's paragraph 13 that begins with the rule that non-performance of assessment work was of no concern to the United States.
Okay.
And paragraph 14 on 236A.
I don't have 236A.
236A?
Yes.
I think we're missing 236A.
A supplemental or replacement appendix was filed because pages 236A and B had been inadvertently omitted from the appendix.
Thank you.
So those were material issues of fact. It is true that the Interior regulations provide that you may ask on appeal after your claims have been declared abandoned and void for a hearing. But the hearing is at the discretion of the Board of Land Appeals, not an assured right. And the board would specify the issues to be raised. That was not an adequate opportunity from the standpoint of Orion, which was objecting that the department had multiple potential objections to the validity of the claims, and unreasonable delay had already occurred in processing the applications.
Are you proffering now that you have evidence that assessment work was actually done?
We have not proffered such evidence.
You have not?
We have not. It is a very extensive factual research matter. We do know that some work was done that may not have been reflected in affidavits assessment work. It's a very large...
You're not in a position now to make a proffer.
Excuse me?
You're not in a position even now to make a proffer on that.
No, we are not. We also rely on the Supreme Court's decision in Darby v. Cisneros. It says The Administrative Procedure Act provides the exclusive requirement for exhaustion of administrative remedies, and that does not include optional proceedings. So we do not lose our rights to seek judicial review from denial of an opportunity for a hearing because we didn't ask the Board of Land Appeals for something that we really didn't want. We didn't want seriatim or piecemeal litigation of one potential objection to the validity of the claims after another. To make matters worse, in its decision, the Board of Land Appeals reasoned that because affidavits had been filed in some years and not in others, that it was an indication that work had not been done in those other years. I think that the soundness of that analysis depends on some unstated factual assumptions, such as the assumption that the claims were all held in common ownership at the time. So another possible unstated assumption is that all of the owners of the claims had equivalent or equal financial resources and inclinations to do work and to file affidavits. There was no requirement to file affidavits. So there were disputed material issues of fact, and under the department's own regulations, we were entitled to a hearing.
The facts that you that to which you're referring and the facts contemplated in paragraph 10, for instance, are facts about the claimant's intent. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So the materiality of those depends upon the continuing relevance of intent.
Well, they were disputed, and I think they were material facts.
Well, they're only material if the law makes intent relevant here, right? I mean, if we were just reading Locke, it would be clear that they are relevant. If we were just reading Hodel, it might be equally clear that intent is not relevant.
Well, the Hickel decision does mention... abandonment as a possible means for establishing the United States' interest in the claims. If the claims had been abandoned, then the United States had an interest in retrieving the lands. And the Bureau of Land Management found that these claims had been abandoned. Its decision was different from that of the Board of Land Appeals, which was clearly based only on federal law. It's our position that the denial of an opportunity for a hearing where there were disputed material issues of fact is a fundamental flaw in these proceedings and should preclude affirmance of the Board of Land Appeals on any theory. These procedures were defective from the beginning, and that defect was not cured by our failure to seek a discretionary hearing from the Board of Land Appeals.
Well, is it your representation that substantial compliance with the assessment work requirements will be shown?
Our basic position is that the Hickel decision and Interior's regulations required that a challenge be made during a period of default. That was the holding in the Krushnick case, and Hickel plainly recognized that was the holding in the Krushnick case. This government challenge was not brought until 1999, at least 29 years after the work was resumed. The government challenge was brought too late. That was the holding of Krushnick. It has not been overruled.
If that's the issue, if you're not going to represent that substantial work was done, if the issue is the timing of the objection, then we don't need a hearing, right? That's a legal issue.
That's right. I think that despite the procedural flaws in this within the department, we are entitled to prevail because it is established that the challenge was brought too late. The 1999 challenge is not in compliance with the temporal limitations of the Hickel decision or of the department's regulations, which said that two respects, one of the United States.
Did you raise that issue before the ILBA?
Excuse me?
Your statute of limitations argument, did you raise that before in the administrative proceedings?
No, we did not raise that specifically within the department, and because we did not understand that the basis of the BLM decision was a purely federal law. The BLM decision concludes with two paragraphs based on the Utah statute. And those paragraphs say that this Utah statute required the filing upon pain of forfeiture. You did not file. Therefore, and that's in, your claims are declared abandoned and void.
But the therefore derives from the federal statutes, not from the Utah laws.
Not in that statement. And it abandonment is an alternative reason for declaring the claims invalid. And they did say, therefore, your claims are invalid for failure to maintain the claims pursuant to the laws under which initiated, which laws include the laws of Utah. And that's the law that they had just been quoting.
Where is that, Mr. Morgan?
The BLM decision is...
Would it be at page 70?
In the appendix.
70, page
70.
Begins at page 68 of the appendix.
Yeah.
Okay.
And at least page 69, at least my version, shows lots of references to Hickel and federal law.
68's all about the mining law of 1872, the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920.
That is true.
That carries over
the, but the last two substantive paragraphs on page 70 are based entirely on the Utah statute. And the middle paragraph says that, therefore, the mining claim has failed to demonstrate to perform qualifying assessment work. The claims are declared abandoned and void. Yes, we say that was a ruling based on the Utah statute, not on federal law, or at least it provided the key finding for application of federal law. And it was not clear that what we were being faced with at the BLM decision level was a federal decision declaring the claims forfeit for lack of performance of assessment work.
Well, what is the, when it's, that paragraph ends with reference to the laws under which they were initiated,
yes,
is the claims.
Right.
And under what laws were the claims initiated?
They're under both federal and state law. The department has argued in this case that you have to comply with both federal and state law. And here you have a Utah statute that requires you, so the government contended, erroneously in our view, that required you to file annual affidavits of assessment work upon pain of forfeiting your claim.
But it,
that was not, in fact, required because the Utah Supreme Court had held that statute inoperative in 1901.
But on page 69 in the first full paragraph, the last sentence says, when a claimant thus fails to maintain oil shale claims in compliance with the assessment work requirements of the mining law, that's the federal mining law, the United States' rights intervene and the resumption doctrine no longer properly applies to these mining claims, see Hickel. Then at the bottom, the very last sentence of the page says, in fact, the claimant did not conduct assessment work for numerous years as evidenced by the claimant's failure to file assessment works with the county. And then it goes on to talk about Utah's requirement. So that, I must say, it sounds like what the government says it is,
well,
which is
what part of the BLM decision you're reading. I agree with that. It talks about federal law, but it concludes with an analysis of Utah law.
But it
and
says it's for purposes of evidence. It says this is evidence, as evidenced by. It doesn't say anywhere that you lose because Utah law gives it to the government. It says that you lose because the mining law gives it to the government if you don't have assessment, and the evidence that you didn't do assessment is that you didn't file. And this is the same argument they're making here, which is that evidence, you know, maybe it's rebuttable evidence, but the evidence of the failure to file is, the fact of failure to file is evidence you didn't do the assessment. Is that an unfair reading of?
The reason this is relevant is the exhaustion doctrine or waiver document, which the department says is a matter of fairness to the department. I think it should also be a matter of fairness to Orion.
No, I don't think that's right. Let's assume, and I think I might be willing to assume, that your paragraph 10 puts preserves the question of intent, your intent. That was but then you still need to put some evidence in.
We said we had evidence bearing on intent, but we had been denied an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing. This proceeding didn't start with a complaint, notice, charges, and an opportunity to answer. It started with a decision.
Yeah, I understand that. But that decision is very much like a filing of a charge or a complaint, right? It doesn't have it. If you go to the BLA or whatever it's called, it has no continuing force. It's a de novo review. You get to put in evidence and to meet the BLM on its own terms as an equal litigant.
We said we were entitled to do that once we had a contest complaint issued that had clear notice of the charges that we were expected to defend against, and an opportunity for hearing. The department has regulations for contest proceedings. It's been followed in many prior oil shale mining claim contests in which I've been involved.
But they didn't initiate a contest. They just put out this decision and left it open to you to initiate, contest the facts.
We can't initiate a contest.
I'm sorry?
All we could do was appeal to the Board of Land Appeals.
Right. But that would enable you to contest the facts de novo, right?
We're not required to pursue an optional proceeding in order to preserve our right to judicial review of their failure to give us, before they declared the claims invalid, notice of the charges and an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing. And we indicated on our filing that there was a lot of evidence that had been introduced in other similar cases. And we were entitled to that, and the BLM decision was procedurally defective because it did not begin with due process or Administrative Procedures Act or Interior Department regulations requirements for notice of charges and an opportunity to defend. Notice of charges before there's a decision. I'd also like briefly to mention that the holding in the Hickel case requiring a challenge during a lapse in work is the law of the land. The Agostini case says unless the Supreme Court itself clearly indicates that a holding is overruled, the courts of appeals should follow it.
You mean the Kruznick case, not the Hickel case?
Excuse me?
You mean in the Kruznick case?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, the Kruznick case. I misspoke.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Oakley.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just try to touch quickly on a few points. First, the standard of review before the IBLA is de novo. It is the decision of the IBLA that binds the agency. And at 40 CFR 4.415, it plainly provides for Orion to have asked for an evidentiary hearing. In addition to the BLM decision being quite clear that this was being done on federal law, there were also a filing of an answer before the IBLA by the BLM, which never said that it was invalidating it on the basis of state law. It said it was invalidating it on the basis of Hickel and the Tenth Circuit decisions in ExxonMobil and Cliff Sinfuel. The best answer we got with that is that, the evidentiary hearing is at the discretion of the board, but if you don't ask, then the board has, there's no showing that the board is operated improperly. As to his reliance on language in the BLM decision at page 70 of the appendix, that it is the claims are, quote, hereby declared abandoned and void for the claimant's failure to properly maintain the claims in compliance under which they are initiated, I'm sorry, which they were initiated. That language is right out of the savings clause in the MLA. It's a quote from the savings clause, the MLA, which allows oil show claims such as this that were located before the effective date of the MLA to be maintained under the older mining law.
Mr. Oakley, yes. Looking at 235 at the 10th paragraph of the statement for reasons for appeal.
Yes, sir.
The last sentence, in those circumstances, there's no warrant for a factual inference that failure to file an affidavit indicated non-performance of work or, as claimed, abandonment of the claims. In context, isn't that reasonably clear that they're asserting that it wasn't their intent to abandon?
Well, I don't think that's sufficient. I think we're in a very similar posture where we'd be at a summary judgment proceeding where BLM had this. Sometimes they filed, sometimes they didn't. They filed more often than they didn't, but they didn't file for a lot of times. And it said that this is in the BLM decision, is prima facie evidence, if they'd filed, that the work was done, and therefore if they haven't filed, it's prima facie evidence that the work wasn't done. So they're merely saying, well, we don't agree with this. We think we're going to dispute this. If this case were coming straight from a district court, on a summary judgment proceeding, someone who simply says, in the face of the movement meeting its standard of burden and its burden of proof, rather, and saying, here are evidence that there's no material issue of fact, to say simply, well, we disagree, would not get you past summary judgment. And I think that's where we are here. They had every opportunity before the IBLA to introduce such evidence. They didn't there. They did in front of Judge Lamberth. And I think in questioning today, they made clear they're not ready to do so today. So just to put in a placeholder and say, well, we don't agree that we intended to abandon, is insufficient in the absence of anything concrete.
Well, at least what they're saying is failure to file an affidavit is not indicative of abandonment. Right?
Well, in that sense, it's a legal argument. And if they're saying it's insufficient.
Well, the legal predicate for the argument is that intent is relevant.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then the factual development would have to follow.
Yes. And I think the first point is wrong under Hickel. And again, the Tenth Circuit certainly rejected it. And the second point, they didn't follow up with the factual.
But if the first point's wrong, if you're correct that the first point is wrong under Hickel.
Yes.
That is a different ground of disposition than saying that they waived this issue.
Yes, I mean, it would then be irrelevant whether they waived or not. But they didn't present the evidence, and the IBLA didn't have a chance to rule on that. So the issue was not preserved.
Questions? Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.